our mission really is to protect the rights to free speech and to privacy in sort of online and digital contexts. So seeing the advantages of technology and how it's changed our society, but just ensuring it's not being used to threaten human rights.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Pam Crowburn, head of communications and campaigns at the Open Rights Group. ORG is the UK's largest grassroots digital rights and privacy campaigning organisation. We're working to protect rights of privacy and free speech online. Prior to ORG, Pam worked as the Director of Communications at Global Criminal Justice Watchdog Fair Trials, and she's also worked for Amnesty International, among other organisations. Pam, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Can you just start by telling us a bit about your journey to where you are today?
My journey is sort of the journey of two parts, I guess, because when I first left university, I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew I sort of wanted to do sort of writing, editing, that sort of thing with words, really. And I worked in jobs in publishing. I worked in for a government department, for a theatre organisation, a children's charity, and this sort of editorial publications type roles, which, you know, I did really enjoy. But really then after sort of freelancing and working for people like Amnesty, as you mentioned, I then got a job with an organisation called Index on Censorship, which is a free speech organisation. And really at that point, I thought, oh, I've really found what I want to do. I want to work in a human rights environment for human rights campaigns. And so that was kind of it, really. I think from there that my career took a sort of slightly different direction. I worked at Index. I then went on to work at Open Rights Group, where I am now, and then actually left and went back in a slightly unusual move. And as you say, I worked for a criminal justice organisation and other sort of organisations working in the sphere of free speech and privacy, mostly.
Yeah. So it feels to me like free speech has actually moved a big way since I was a journalist, and huge attacks on it from both left and right. Tell us a bit about ORG's mission and how it works.
Yeah, so our mission really is to protect the rights to free speech and to privacy in sort of online and digital contexts. So really, looking at sort of obviously the digital world, which is, you know, everywhere now. So not, you know, websites, content moderation, surveillance apps, so we're looking at that in that sort of, that context, and just protecting that right. So seeing the advantages of technology and how it's changed our society, but just ensuring it's not being used to threaten human rights. And our mission also is to really recognise that those harms that come are not always, not everybody, people are affected differently as well by the sort of threats to digital rights. So we campaign by raising awareness, we lobby Parliament, lobby governments, we take legal actions really just to ensure that there are protections in place and that people's rights are safeguarded, and that we sort of technology is there to sort of enhance our lives, not to restrict our speech or impinge on our privacy unnecessarily.
So what are some of the examples of where that free speech has been infringed upon and where you've helped?
So with free speech, there's been an Online Safety Act, which has just been passed, and sort of content regulation and those sort of areas. That's where we see threats to freedom of expression online and what we might say, and ensuring that there isn't excessive regulation of content online that might restrict speech or ban certain kinds of speech, or even in ways of having like websites being blocked, for example. For, you know, there's one of our the tools we provide is a service called Blocks, where websites people can check whether their websites are blocked by parental controls. They may be incorrectly being blocked, for example. There's other aspects of free speech. So, for example, we campaign around the Prevent program, where people may be reported, mostly children, to Prevent, which is a counter-terrorism program, for things that they may have said online or in other contexts. And then their data is then, you know, can be retained and shared for years, even though they haven't actually committed a crime. So there's in those sort of very specific sort of surveillance contexts as well, that free speech can be suppressed.
And what are some of the things that they might be saying that might get that kind of action?
In Prevent, I mean, well, it's kind of interesting with something like Prevent. We don't always know what will trigger it, because this is often done in my schools, in, you know, doctors. There's a number of sort of, if you like, people in public authorities who have responsibilities under the Prevent duty. And they are categorised, the government publishes figures. So at the moment, there are more referrals around sort of what's categorised as far right extremism, whereas typically it's always been a large number of what's been come under Islamism, Islamist extremism. But we have seen people being, I mean, there's a really the famous one as a child being referred drawing a cucumber that was mistaken for a cooker bomb. So there's been some very innocuous reasons that people have been referred to the Prevent programme. As we said, the recent figures show that there were 4,000 under 18s who were referred last year. So obviously the concern of that is that children making comments that they may not fully understand are being referred to a counter-terrorism programme, as opposed to maybe being challenged for views that they may be expressing. You know, no matter if those views seem extreme, but having sort of context that they can be challenged in rather than referred to a counter-terrorism programme.
Yeah. 4,000 in the UK, is it? 4,000 under 18s?
4,000 under 18s, yeah.
And as you're pointing out there, one child drawing a cucumber and that being mistaken for a bomb, and they've been...
That was many. Yeah, that was a few years ago, but yeah, that was, you know, a sort of famous. But the, you know, there's been other instances that we've heard about that, you know, that just seems as excessive overreach to refer kids in this way.
Yeah. Any others?
We actually produced a report at the start of this year that showed a lot of cases of children being referred, and then that having like a huge impact on their life. They're then being denied offers of school places as well as subsequently, because they've had this Prevent referral. And it's really important to note that when people get referred to Prevent, it's not because they've committed a crime, because obviously laws exist to prosecute someone. It's because they are, you know, it's seen as that they've raised a concern. So they haven't actually done anything that's met a threshold of criminal behaviour. They've just made a comment.
Right. And so you're getting people in the UK that don't even know that they might be marked as a possible terrorist threat, and they might be applying for jobs and they might not be getting the jobs and don't know why, or they might not be getting bank accounts and mortgages.
I don't think there's, as far as we know, that's not, that information wouldn't be shared in that way. It's more like to be shared around government departments, but there is still a lack of transparency. But certainly for children, we know that the Prevent referrals would be referred to local authorities. So obviously they then go on, and I think that's kept for about 25 years, that they then go on to have children themselves. There's a local authority, you know, social services would have a reference that they've been referred. When people have actually then referred to the what's called a channel program, their data can then be shared with ports and airports, for example. We know there's quite wide data sharing. So there has been, this report we produced did actually expose this. There has been, you know, concerns that people are being referred to Prevent are then being stopped at airports under Schedule 7 and the Terrorism Act, which where you can stop somebody can be stopped without any suspicion. So sort of that sort of drew that connection of why that might be happening if their data is being shared in that way. So obviously, you know, there's real consequences for somebody who's being referred. And as we say, most people being referred are children.
And what can people do to find out if they have been referred? And
I think they would have to really try and do subject access requests from their local authority. So obviously, if you're referred and there's a process when you're referred, and if it goes on to have a channel program, you will know about it if you're asked for it. But there could be many cases, but most cases are referred and they don't progress any further. So that would, you know, so yeah, as you say, you might not even know that you've ever been referred or that your child has been referred. But if you suspect that, then they would have to be sort of a subject access request. And obviously that's quite a lengthy part of the issue, is it then, because this data is shared, how that, you know, finding all the different organisations that might help that information is a long and tricky process.
Wow, yeah. What's been one of your biggest communications wins over the years?
Well, I'm going to talk about a recent one, actually, just partly because it's very fresh in my mind, but it's been a very nice campaign. So we produced a report about the government's e-visa scheme. So these are proposals that have, well, were sort of started quite a long time ago, a couple of years ago, but have sort of accelerated this year as the deadline looms. So the Home Office wants to take all, at the moment, people who are not EU citizens but have the right to be in the UK have sort of different ways of proving their immigration status, which tend to be physical documents. So most people have a biometric residence permit, a BRP, that they can show to that they can be in the UK and can travel in and out of the UK. But there are a few other variations of that, including people have like stamps and passports, old sort of legacy documents. And the Home Office has set a deadline for the end of this year for everybody to switch to have e-visas, which would be a sort of not just an online digital status, but basically something that will be generated every time somebody needed to prove their status. And there's a lot of flaws in both the design and the rollout and the implementation of this scheme. In terms of rollout, lots of people not even knowing that they needed to do this, but also having real problems, delays, and managing the transfer. There was lots of accessibility issues about setting up an e-visa. You needed a certain kind of smartphone. Everything was written in English. You needed to be quite pretty digitally literate, which not everybody is. There's lots of particularly older migrants who, you know, really struggled with this. But also we know from previous schemes that there's lots of issues with the actually, when these the sort of glitches within the technical side of the system, so that people are looking at their trying to prove their status and it's coming up with old information or someone else's information, or it might glitch or time out if there's a problem with the Home Office databases. So we produced a report on this in September, and we did a webinar about it, and we actually timed this to it launched alongside a sort of the government push around e-visas. And we, you know, we got some media coverage from reports, which led then to actually were contacted by lots of migrants who just said, yes, I'm experiencing these problems. And so we, again, that sort of, we actually put them in touch, numbered migrants in touch with the Guardian, who did subsequent articles, very good journalist there, Diane Taylor, did subsequent reports about some of the issues migrants were having in setting this up. And we also, you know, this in itself generated meetings with the Home Office and with MPs. We set up an action. We've got Open Rights Group has a sort of active supporter base. You know, we asked our supporters to email their MPs, and we also asked migrants who were experiencing difficulties to email their MP as well. So we had, you know, MPs like Dawn Butler were involved and, you know, took an interest in what was happening. This is, a combination of this sort of political lobbying and awareness raising really was managed to sort of, you know, and then this is alongside, there's many other migrant groups who are also working on this. We were particularly focusing on some of the technical issues, but there's been a number of organisations working on this for several years. So the cutoff for this switchover was the end of the 31st of December. We've kind of predicted this was going to be chaos in January when many migrants are going to be returned to the UK, may not have had their e-visa properly set up. Their physical documents of all the BRPs have been set to expire on the 31st of December. So yeah, we foresaw tremendous problems after Christmas. The government appears to have listened to this, and at the sort of 11th hour has delayed the sort of cutoff for the scheme. They have said that people can use their expired documents, which may be a little bit problematic, and I'm sure there will be some confusion, but at least means that people have a sort of backup, you know, that there is, that, you know, feel a bit more secure I think, that, yeah. that this has been announced. And that gives us a few more months to be able to get the sort of changes that we think need to be made to make this so that people can actually have, you know, improve their status whenever they need to. Mm. Fundamentally, we want them to be able to have some kind of physical backup or something they can save rather than relying on a system that will sort of generate their status as and when it's needed.
Yeah, and I mean, the end of December was always going to be an awful time to have the cutoff point, because clearly that's when lots of people go back to their home countries for Christmas, for the Christmas holidays. So I'm glad to hear that families coming back into the UK who have a complete legitimate right to be in the UK but might not have the right admin paperwork aren't going to be stuck at the border and forced out. So really good example there of how, you know, working together, and actually, you know, when you do work together, you're talking about working with other partner organizations, other organizations all pushing in the same direction, but also working with different communication streams, so public affairs and media working together, because ultimately it's not about just getting a headline in the Guardian, it's about what does that lead to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say with this, I mean, we're all about changing policy. We're not about helping, you know, individuals, really. That's not our role. We don't have that expertise. But to be able to actually help some individuals as well, we did manage to get some people in touch with the Home Office. You know, I've had sort of text from people saying, oh, I've finally got some help, thank you. You know, and that actually is really gratifying to actually see the results of sort of changes being actually made, because often in policy it's feels quite distant. People that, you know, are being impacted.
Have you ever had an instance where something hasn't quite landed as well as you'd have liked?
Yes, several. I mean, obviously, a lot of what, you know, challenging government is really difficult. You know, there's a lot of opposition there. And I would say probably one of the biggest examples of that I've worked on was post the Snowden revelations, where there was revelations about, you know, mass surveillance by the US and UK government, and quite an interesting difference in how those were addressed. You know, the US did have a lot more hearings, it was a lot more open, and sort of laws were passed. In the UK, it was kind of slightly a neither confirm nor deny approach. But then a law was drafted and presented that essentially included everything that Snowden had said, plus a few extra bits of surveillance in there as well. So we campaigned around this bill. It was called the Investigatory Powers Bill, now an act. Again, this was done in coalition with a number of other organisations. And it was just very difficult. It was very difficult getting positive press coverage, or any press coverage, actually. There was a lot going on. It was around the time, just because the run-up to the Brexit referendum. There was, I think, also possibly some proprietal behaviour by, you know, The Guardian had broken the Snowden story, and so other newspapers may be less interested in that. And I think also just very difficult to get coverage of threats that might happen, you know, without the tangible examples. So just talking about that the e-visa report, we did have people contacting us and going, I'm experiencing these issues. So you can sort of like have some proof and evidence, but it's very difficult, particularly on surveillance powers, to sort of say, this is what this will mean in the future. You know, and it's quite often even hard getting those examples. So I think that was just incredibly difficult. And there was an awareness, and there was certainly a growth in our organisation and membership, and people were interested and probably on social media, but it was very difficult getting press coverage until the bill was passed. And then, you know, there was loads of reports about it, but that was, you know, that was hard. And it was hard to just challenge the bill itself, you know, there was organisations working on it, and it was just incredibly difficult because of the subject matter.
Yeah. Well, there's a good point you just raised there, and I'll just expand on it. The one that Snowden was seen as a Guardian story, and quite often I get people asking me kind of strategically, should we go to a particular journalist, should we do a media partnership? And lots of people don't know that sometimes when a story is seen as being owned by a particular media organization, it's quite hard to then get it into other publications. Another good example is the very powerful investigation that was done by the Times at the time into the grooming gangs in the north of England, which was shamefully not covered fully by the rest of the media, and has in large parts led to a lot of the far-right extremism in this country now, almost 10 years later. But that was a story that The Guardian just kept on and on and on really powerfully. But it is always worth thinking about, you know, once someone breaks an exclusive, it's sometimes seen as their exclusive by other parts of the media, and it's harder to get in. Are there any particular forms of media that you really think are really work?
Are you talking traditional media or social media or?
Out of everything.
Well, I think the shift, I mean, I think the sort of probably the big learning from the Trump election, from the American election, Trump victory, was just like the power of social media platforms, podcasts, YouTube channels, and actually how that, I mean, I think really, you know, just the role that they played in his success when, if you like, the inverted bracket mainstream media weren't necessarily backing him. So, I mean, I think that there's something there for all campaigners to learn from, to the, where we're trying to get and where we're trying to be. But that said, I do think there is a role, you know, like we had from The Guardian and Times covered this Steve Easter story, and that did have, you know, an impact. It does still reach people. And I think particularly for our audience ultimately tends to be politicians who we want to do things. So they are still influenced by media, by, you know, by print. They've called it print because we all read it online, but, you know, the old school media and broadcast, of course, as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah. How about what you read and listen to when you're on your down days? What do you like?
Well, I do like a podcast, you know, I did follow a lot of the American election. I listened to Americast, BBC. I really like that as a podcast. And I do like, you know, The Rest Is Politics, The News Agents, the sort of general sort of current affairs podcasts. And I do actually really try and watch the news now. I've really started doing that. I'm trying to move away from just sort of social media and the snippets, which can be a bit exhausting, and actually just properly watch, you know, news programs and concentrate on them. I think that or listening as well, you know, I just get a far better understanding of, you know, what's going on, rather than trying to move away from snippets on social media.
Yeah. How does that? Well, I think things are going to move back to the curation, because essentially both a newspaper and a news show, I'm not talking about a 24-hour news program, I'm talking about the news at 10, are both curated. They have both had, you know, professional journalists with years of experience looking at all the stories of today, of that day, and saying, these are the most important ones, and this is their importance in order. You know, this is the top story, the second story, third story, fourth story. Same thing with the newspaper. Your top story is on this splash. Your second story is on page three, then two, then five, then four, in that order due to the way your eyes move. And you don't really get that from a website that's constantly moving, and you certainly don't get it from a X feed, formerly Twitter feed. And I mean, I had a go at being a news editor for a bit. I really didn't like it, because you just spend all day watching a Reuters feed and a Press Association feed. And I couldn't ever understand why people would do that if they're not being paid to do it, i.e. essentially be trying to work out what's the important stories of the day as they're happening. It's just exhausting. Because if you've ever tried news editing, you just want to flop after seeing thousands of stories and trying to sort out in your head which are the ones that our readers want and which are the ones that aren't. And essentially, if you're looking on social media quite often, that's what you're doing. You're just being like a news editor on a newspaper.
Yeah, so I think also you miss, I mean, it's very easy, obviously, to be in your bubble, and especially if you work in a particular campaigning area. So sometimes I sort of think things that are happening in the digital rights sphere are like really important. Obviously, everyone else I know is like, well, what are you talking about? But also I might miss something like quite big that's going on. So I do find that a bit like reading a newspaper, then you will actually touch on things that you might not have read before or might not have, just come up on your feed, really.
Yeah. And actually, a great example for me is Syria. You know, before that happened, I was thinking, I don't really know enough about Syria. And had it not been for newspapers, I might have thought, you know what, I've got enough stories that I care about and world events. I know that happens to a lot of people. People go, you know what, I've got enough in my life. I don't need to learn about problems happening on the other side of the world. But a newspaper and a news program forces you to really hear about the stories you might not have chosen to go to. And the more you hear about them, the more you take an interest in them. So it has that kind of process of forcing you to kind of go a bit on the stories that might be a bit harder. And the more you read about what's happening in Syria, the more you think, oh my God, one, why didn't we know more? Why were we turning such a blind eye to what was happening there? And it's just now such a fascinating story for everyone. Are there any campaigns that Higginson Strategies working on that you know that you're?
Well, I think a lot of your sort of environmental campaigns, so the plastics and the blood, which is pretty terrifying. But just generally, obviously, it's probably the story of our time, really, and not getting the action that needs. I mean, I think there's obviously awareness, but I think all of those campaigns are just incredibly important and relevant, and hopefully we'll need to have some successes, really. And I think I sort of see analogies to actually sort of a lot of campaigning around surveillance and rights, is that sometimes these things can seem sort of too big to be able to change them. I was going to say they can feel removed, but I don't think that is environmentally now. I think because people are suddenly becoming, that feels like, we're seeing extreme weather, fires in Europe, that people are, it feels like it is happening now. But actually, I think there's a lot to be learned from environmental campaigns that are very tangible and showing actual results and have clear outcomes of things that can be done.
Well, I'm glad that you're saying that, because for someone who's outside of, working on in environmental campaigns, because all the environmental campaigners feel like environmentalism is moving out of fashion and some of that stuff there. So it's good to see someone that sits outside it is just seeing the larger picture. And obviously, bigger picture is the world is warming up. Climate change is happening. It's having a massive disastrous effect. Plastic is inextricably linked to climate change, being because it is made out of a fossil fuel, oil, and that's it's essentially a physical form.
Sorry, it'd be a meow then. My young kitten has just...
for those that can't see Pam's cat has just come onto the show. If you'd give one message to your younger self, what would it be?
It would be the same as a message to my older self and to pretty much all the women I've worked with, to just acknowledge imposter syndrome exists and to just sort of control it and deal with it and not let it hold you back. But I think just for so many women, I've just seen this throughout my career, really, just lack confidence at times and their ability to do things. So that would be certainly my advice to my younger self.
And final question, if you could have dinner with anyone alive or dead, who would it be?
So I think I thought about, there's obviously a lot of authors and singers and people but they might end up being a bit disappointing. So actually I would pick a good friend of mine called Claire, who died about 10 years ago. I'd like to have dinner with her and a catch up and to tell her about what I've been doing in life. That would be my choice. Nice. And I know it wouldn't be disappointing in any way. It'd be
very nice. Never meet your heroes.
Exactly. Also, they might just make you feel bad. They're going to be really successful. You'll be like, oh, what have I done?
Pam Kelburn, Head of Communications and Campaigns at the Open Rights Group. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you.